Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello, and welcome to Interchange, the longest-running public affairs talk show in Bloomington. My name is Ashley Beeman. Tonight we have two outstanding guests here in the firehouse. One is internationally known Dr. Jill Taylor Bolte, whose story is well known to most of us. It's a story of hope and health and can never be heard too often. Our other guest is Nathan Mishler of Studio Cypher, a Bloomington-based company that creates interactive games and displays. Nathan talks about how the concept of fun is being redefined in the 21st century, as well as the fascinating ways in which computer games interact with and challenge young people. Let's start with our first segment. Reporter Susan Hu talks with Dr. Jill Taylor Bolte.
Welcome to Interchange. My name is Susan Hu. Today we are very honored to have Dr. Jill Taylor here to join us in our discussion. Dr. Taylor is the author of My Stroke of Insight. She is the founder of the Brain Extravaganza. She's also the spokesperson for the Harvard Brain Tissue Resource Center. She was once named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine. I'm very interested in your personal experience from a neuroanatomist to an activist in educating people about brain-related research. Can you share a little bit about your stories with us?
Well, I was teaching and performing research at Harvard Medical School when a blood vessel exploded in the left half of my brain. And in the course of 4 hours, I watched my mind completely deteriorate in its ability to process all incoming information. So on the afternoon of a rare form of stroke, I could not walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of my life. And typical protocol in neuroscience says that the brain is not really capable of much recovery, especially from this kind of major trauma. And it took 8 years for me to completely recover all function, and then I wrote the book, My Stroke of Insight, which is now coming out in 30 languages. So it's been quite a profound experience and an incredible, you use the term activist, I guess in some ways I am, but I consider myself a real advocate for the ability of the brain to recover. And in treating individuals as though they are survivors instead of victims so that they actually do have the capacity to get better.
Do you think it was because of your professional experience helped you to recover from the trauma better or faster than others?
I do. I think that I had a basic understanding and respect and appreciation for the organ itself, for the brain, and I believed that my brain knew better than anyone else what it needed in order to recover. And if I paid very close attention and gave it what it needed, then I essentially was getting me out of the way of the recovery process. So, for example, if I was very tired, I would close the world out and shut down and go to sleep. And so in the beginning, I slept volumes in comparison to what traditional rehabilitation usually permits a stroke survivor to sleep. But my brain wanted to be to shut down new incoming stimulation so that it had the capacity to make sense of the stimulation that it did experience. So I do think that being a neuroanatomist, certainly being someone who valued and appreciated the organ and its ability to know what it needed in order to recover, I do think that gave me an advantage.
And can you talk a little bit about your book, My Stroke of Insight?
Well, My Stroke of Insight, I wrote because so many people were calling me up and saying, you know, my loved one has had a stroke. What did you do? What did you need? What got in the way of what you needed in order to recover? So I documented it in my Stroke of Insight, and that was at the around the 8-year point when I felt that I was completely recovered. So the book now is coming out in, it was served, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for over 4 months. And, it's been a marvelous experience writing that message out into the world. And still I receive literally dozens of emails every day from people somewhere in the world who are reading the book and finding it of value for one reason or another.
In this book for you, is it more like a personal experience for you to write down and share everything with people who have similar experience, or is it more like you would like to spread the knowledge about this?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. You know, I am who I am in the world, and I am committed to and passionate about sharing what I've learned about my brain, about the ability of the brain to recover. And at the same time, I'm absolutely huge on education about the brain and helping people gain an appreciation of what this beautiful organ is inside of our head and how it truly is worthy of our paying attention to it, learning about it. The more we understand about it, the better we can get it to do what we really want it to do in order to make our dreams come true.
Do you think your experience of this joke help you to look and bring in a more different perspective?
I really do. Before it was much more academic, much more university-based education, teaching at the medical school. At the time, I was teaching at Harvard, neuroanatomy, gross anatomy, and then after the recovery process, I was back to teaching at the medical school level here at the Indiana University School of Medicine here in Bloomington, so both neuroanatomy again and some gross. So you know, there's that academic piece of it, which is important, but at the same time, it's a real message of hope. Here you have someone who could not walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of their life by anyone's measure. I was an infant in a woman's body. And to be able to regain function, and not just function, but normal function, full steam ahead with passion and energy, it really speaks volumes for people who are working with patients who are in those conditions. I encourage my audiences to remember me. You know, if you're an occupational therapist or a physical therapist or a nurse or a physician, speech therapist, whatever you are, you're the hands-on to this population. And it's really difficult to look at these individuals and think, oh my gosh, somebody in this condition could recover completely. So I encourage my colleagues to remember me, look at me, think of me, and treat that survivor as though they have the capacity to recover. Is it going to happen overnight? Absolutely not. Neurons are in absolutely no hurry whatsoever. We are in much bigger hurry than they are, but if we set the brain up for success, then the brain has more opportunity to actually succeed in its recovery.
I think that's a very noble and a very brave action you've been doing, because I'm pretty sure it must be very difficult for you, I mean, emotionally difficult to look back for the 8 years.
Well, it was very difficult when I wrote the book, because you're exactly right. In order to write something that has that much meaning to it, I had to go back and relive it and re-feel it and re-put myself back into those scenarios in order to be able to communicate them in a way that makes the reader feel like they are there experiencing the stroke with me. So the writing of the book was an emotional drama, if you will, and challenge because of that. But I have to say that after that, it's just been a lot of fun, because, you know, I've gotten to ride this incredible wave of success, and it's just been a wonderful experience.
It's very interesting, because you described it as a lot of fun.
The whole process of having a book, you know, go out into the world, be found of value by the medical community, by the treatment community, by people who are survivors, by people who are trying to seek a better understanding of how do I find my own peace, how do I quiet my own left brain. It's been a wonderful opportunity to help people know themselves better and to get better. And so that's been a very satisfying experience.
And that's it's a very great thing for everyone too. I know to spread the knowledge of brain issues, you have established this organization called Extravaganza. Can you tell us a little bit about this? What is the basic concept and what is the purpose of it?
Well, I've created a not-for-profit called Jill Bolte Taylor Brains. And the purpose of Jill Bolte Taylor Brains is to create education, appreciation, awareness, prevention from trauma, an understanding of the relationship between physical movement and the health and well-being of the brain. So it's really all about the brain. I care about this brain. I care about other people knowing about the brain, talking about the brain, having language about the brain, communicating about the brain, students learning about the brain, whether, you know, it's second graders or whether it's sixth graders or eighth graders or 12th graders or college students or anybody. I just love the brain, and so I've decided this is the first real effort out into the world to create a collaborative art project inside of Bloomington that is truly community-based, and it's called the Brain Extravaganza. And other communities, 350 other communities, have had some type of fiberglass animal or thing, be it a piano or a cow, whatever, on display for tourist reasons. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be marvelous if here in Bloomington we had big brains on display? And so I threw the idea out, and it's gotten some real footage and some real leverage, and currently we have 20 sponsors for 20 brains. So we've moved forward with the project. We are going to have at least 20 brains, big, enormous brains, beautiful brains. They're going to be 5 feet high, 5 feet long, 4 feet wide brains that will be decorated by local artists or groups of individuals who submit ideas to us of what they would like to do. And it's really growing into a true extravaganza. It's not just going to be there are 20 brains on the B line or downtown or across IU campus or around in the community. We have lots of support from the community itself. We have support from IU, and they're interested in how can they turn this into an educational programming and get the students excited about what's going on. So that's going to bring in new technology. We'll probably have a fascinating app for phones to go from brain to brain and have some type of scavenger interest. It's going to be a wonderful educational program. I'm hoping to hook into the MCCSC so that we could have all kinds of different things going on at the different age groups to get people really aware and talking about the brain. And it's really already happening, and the fire is already being fanned by different people in the community. So it's been a beautiful experience in turning this into a truly collaborative art project that involves the basic community, the business community, the city, IU, and hopefully the school system.
So basically, for my understanding, it's more like raise awareness.
Absolutely. It'll raise awareness about the organ. Each of the 20 brains will be focused on some kind of something that has to do with the brain. So it'll be awareness, it'll be education, it'll be fun and interesting and exciting. People are going to walk around and have a whole new language and understanding about the brain and how the brain works. You know, people are going to use the word hippocampus. They're going to use the word amygdala. They're going to understand this kind of language related to their own brains and about how we get to communicate with this beautiful organ. So I'm very excited about what's going to happen in 2012.
So can we expect to see those 20 brains in 2012 around Bloomington?
Currently, we're scheduling to have them on display. We hope to get them back from the artist by the middle of April. We would have a big photo shoot experience where we can put all the 20 brains together, or however many there end up being by that point, and having a photo shoot of them as a collection. And then they will go up on, they'll be mounted throughout the city or throughout campus or wherever they're going to be. We want to get them up the week before graduation, IU graduation hits, so that they will be on display for the graduates and their families who will be in town. And then we will keep them up through May, June, July, August, September, and we'll probably take them down sometime in October.
And what can we expect from those brains, except for those huge, really eye-catching artistic statues? Can I say that?
Well, I think that you can expect to see whatever the community brings to the project. That's part of the beauty of this. We're hoping that perhaps once a month, in relationship to the farmers market and wherever the brains are, there can be some kind of something, an actual participation by different community members. If you've got a subject material, let's say you deal with the aged brain and you deal with the senior brain, then what possibly could you bring to the extravaganza that could go up on display between some of the brains, so that people who are touring the brains on that afternoon could stop and have some type of fitness experience or have some type of knowledge experience. So that's going to be the mystery. That's going to be the wide open, and that will come. We'll figure all those details out along the way. So anybody who has an idea, I encourage you to contact us, because we're very open about inclusiveness. This is a true community collaboration, so bring it on.
And so where can our audience contact you if
they
have some
idea? Best way to get me
is
through email. My email is Dr. Jill, which is drjill at drjilltaylor.com. So Dr. Jill at drjilltaylor.com.
And we can also find other information about extravaganza.
Well, you know, we're in the process of putting it all together. So this is the kind of project where we didn't know if we were going to run it until we had enough community support to sponsor 12 brains. And that happened a few weeks ago, and so we've moved forward to create the prototype. And so right now we're in the prototype creating phase. And we hope to then have that finished by the end of next week. And we'll do a call for artists who would like to do work on one of the brains in early October. And once that happens, you know, we're creating it as we go.
Yeah, that sounds very exciting. I'm very looking forward to seeing all those brains.
I think it's going to be beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Except for those brain displays, what else education have you and the organizations been doing?
Well, I travel for business most of the time. So I have my primary job in the world, I have to say, is keynoting at conferences, either in the States or throughout the world. So a lot of my time is spent somewhere other than Bloomington. And last year I had the privilege of going to Asia, Europe, as well as South America. And next year I'll be going to Antarctica, which ought to be very exciting.
So talking about brain, what should we learn about brain and how can we learn more about it?
Well, I think that paying attention to what's going on in our own brain gives us an idea of, you know, how it functions. I think that we're going to learn some basic anatomy, we're going to some basic organization, we're going to understand how the structure of the brain defines function inside of the brain. Most of the functions we can kind of relate to, but most of us probably have never thought or considered, you know, how is it that I can actually depict a shadow? How is it that my brain tracks a moving target through space? How is it that I can control the wiggling of my little finger? So I think we're going to learn about the structure and the function of the brain, and it's going to be all the way from really fundamental basic information, and again, we're going to become proficient with a language and an understanding and hopefully an appreciation of the beautiful organ.
The appreciation of this beautiful organ.
Yeah.
Okay.
That excites me.
Yeah, I think especially from your experience, I think you're a very brave person. You are not afraid to share your experience, even though some part of it wasn't that pleasant. But thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you. No, you know, it's important because as a scientist, as a neuroanatomist, I learned so much about my brain when I really had the privilege of losing half of it. Because we think about ourselves as a single individual, and it's very difficult as a single individual with two halves of our brain working together and communicating constantly to really have an understanding about what happens inside of the left brain and what happens inside of the right brain, and what is it like if you actually lose one or the other. And on the case of my situation, I lost my left brain, I lost my language, my linearity of thought, my ability to create boundary. So it was a fascinating experience.
And it's more fascinating because for now, you totally get back the ability of your language and you could even write a book.
Yeah, well, you know, I couldn't write the book until I was recovered.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was the beauty of working so hard and then being rewarded with the willingness to share what I had learned with others so that they could gain that information, they could gain that insight without having to go through the traumatic experience.
Yeah, I think that's really the beauty of it. We've been talking to Dr. Jill Taylor. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Susan. I appreciate it.
Second segment, Nathan Mishler talks about computer games, interactive computer design, and a new emerging definition of fun.
Good afternoon. My name is William Morse, and I'm here in the studio today with Nathan Mishler of Studio Cipher. Nathan's going to talk to us this afternoon about what I think are some very interesting ideas. The ideas of fun. What is play? What is a game? And how do these connect to education? And how do these connect then to computers, interactive gaming, and just a whole array of really interesting things? Nathan, good to have you with us.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Nathan, first of all, tell us a little, just start a little bit with what you do. What is it you do?
Well, I'm part of a three-person team. We're called Studio Cipher. We're a company here in Bloomington. And we all have been living here for about 7 years. We came here for our master's degrees and decided it would be a great idea to start a company.
So where are you from?
I'm from Goshen, Indiana.
Oh, okay.
Which is about northern Indiana. It's just south of Michigan.
Okay, very good. So you guys have been here for quite a while now.
Yeah, about since 2003.
Mm-hmm. And did you come here to study computers?
I actually came here to study art. Because my father's a sculptor, and I was getting tired of computers at the time, and came down and thought I would try to change and see if I wanted to do art more. I did art, and I found out there was a master's degree in interactive media, and I thought, oh, well, I should probably be doing that. So that's really when I first stepped into, I'm really going to be doing this interactive media games stuff.
And how long have you been doing it now?
7 years.
Okay, very good. You know, one of the things that you and I have had a chance to talk about is this idea of defining fun.
Yes.
And carry us through that a little bit.
Okay, well, the thing to think about is that often we use words and we kind of assume that we know what they mean. Fun, enjoyment, play, games. But really, especially since we all have master's degrees in these things, we think a lot about what we mean when we say fun. And I'm not going to define fun for you yet. I'm going to define some other stuff first.
Okay.
So the first thing I'm going to do is define what play is. And I'm not really talking play in the theatrical sense, although you can really apply it. I'm talking about, well, let's use an example, the game of tag. Because we all probably played tag when we were kids, and we know how to that you run around and you touch somebody and you run away and they chase you. And that is an example of play. And when we say, well, what does that mean? What are the components of play? Well, what the components of play are is, the first, we have a thing called we call the magic circle. And the magic circle means there's a place where the play happens. You know when you're playing tag and you know when you're not playing tag. You generally don't play tag in the classroom. You play it out on the blacktop in recess. So it's got this magic circle. It's also got rules, rules of behavior. And when you enter this, you know, here's what I can do, here's what I can't do, here's what I should do, here's what's accepted. So you have that. It has rules.
Of play.
Rules of play. Rules of behavior, really. Play is rules of behavior in the magic circle. And the third component of that is that generally the actions that we take in play have no meaning outside of it. So the things we do when we play tag, or even when we play football, you know, you're not going to run around and tackle somebody just randomly on the street. You know that this is the place you take these actions, you take them outside the magic circle, you don't do those things generally.
Not even that in football. In football, you don't tackle people outside the lines.
That's true.
You only tackle them in the lines.
Yes. There's very specific rules about what you can do, when you can do it. And the final part of play is entered into freely. You cannot force somebody to play. If you tackle somebody and they are not playing along, that is aggravated assault.
So then carry that over then to this idea of fun.
I'm going to take one more
okay.
step.
Okay.
So before we get to fun, I want to talk about games. Because people, when they talk about play and they talk about games, they generally think of frivolity, especially when they say fun. So before we get to fun, I want to talk a little bit about what a game is. So what a game is it's play. It's got all the attributes we just talked about. But it adds rules that determine if you win or if you lose.
Okay.
So not all games you can win at. Some games, especially computer games, you can only lose. It's how far do you get before you lose. But sports, for instance, or football, let's say football, because football is a game at this point. It is not a sport. So football, the game, has a clear winner and a loser. You know when you've won, you know when you've lost. Fun. Now we'll define fun.
But you know, before we go on, because you and I have talked about this a little bit, just for our listeners, you can have football, though, as play.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be a game.
You can modify the rules of football, to modify the what you do inside the magic circle, which in football is the playing field. And if you remove the aspect of winning and losing, you're just running the ball back and forth. You might even be scoring points, but you decide at the end, well, we're not going to say who won and who lost. At that point, we are just playing.
Right.
We are not gaming.
And of course, you see people playing frisbee football or flag football or co-ed football, and those certainly are different levels of games within the idea. Some of them even totally within the idea of play.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So moving on to fun.
Fun.
Okay.
So what fun is then is your brain telling you that it is learning. That is our broadest example of what fun is. So why we say that play and games give you fun is because one of the major components is rules. There are rules of behavior. And when you're playing this game, not only are you learning what the rules are, but you're learning how to apply the rules and how to maybe even sometimes skirt around the rules. But you're really working inside of a framework of behavior. I mean, this is very sociological stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so fun is your brain going, aha, I can do this. I can do that. I can run this way and maybe I'll do better. Or I can throw the ball at this time. I can do things like that. So that, when we define fun, that means that eventually, well, it actually, one of the interesting implications is eventually you run out of fun, which is why people change games.
Very interesting.
Because the newness wears off.
I know that some of the things you all do at Studio Cypher is then create, what? What do you create?
Well, we do make games.
Okay.
We are a game creation studio, and we make games that exist in the real world and physical spaces where people, we just ran something in Lotus Fest, actually, this past weekend, where people had a physical piece of paper, and they were charged, this is actually more a play than game, but they were charged with going around town and finding pieces of art and taking pictures of them. So that was actually play, but we did have points and a winner, so it was a game then. It was mostly play, but we had a winner. So we do physical games. We also do video games. We're actually video game artists is the biggest thing we do. And we have a series of kiosk games inside kiosks, so games that are in physical computers on location in several different places, such as the Field Museum in Chicago, and Feed the Children facility in Oklahoma City. And we also do games online on the internet where anybody in the world can play them.
Let's go on out to Oklahoma and talk about Feed the Children and what you do at that particular project. Let's go through these and see how the concepts of play and games and fun work with the things that you do.
All right. That's a very good thing to start with, because that is actually the simplest game we have out there to play. It is, so...
And this is in what city?
This is Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And let me tell you a little bit about the facility it's in first, because the game is a primer to the experience. So the experience that they're really going for is giving people the ability to experience what life is like in a Kenyan slum without actually going to Kenya. Because Feed the Children's big its mission statement is feeding the children. So they want people to donate money, and they want people to understand why they're donating money. So this is, you can think of the facility as kind of like Disney, but a slum.
Mm-hmm.
So there's quote-unquote rides. There's rooms you can go in. There's video. They're actually piping in smells so you know
what it is. It's a simulation.
It's a simulation.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they brought us in to do is prime the pump a little bit as far as knowledge goes, because fun, as we said, is a lot about knowledge. So even if you can prime the pump and be like, okay, I'm going to teach you something and I want you to kind of know what you don't know. And so what we've got there, it's actually a multiple choice quiz game. So it's not very, it's got a lot of audio and visual, but it's, as far as the rules and gameplay go, it's not very sophisticated, but it exists. So anybody who comes into this space, because you can treat the whole thing as a sort of magic circle. And so when you're going into the very beginning of the magic circle, I want to tell you that you're in a magic circle. I want to tell you kind of, if not the rules, at least the setting. Here's where you're going. Here's what you're going to do. Here's what you're going to think about. And so what this multiple choice quiz really is saying, well, what do you know about Kenyan slums? What do you know about this organization? How do you know about your connection between yourself and them over in Kenya? And so a lot of the real learning in that facility happened in the rest of the experience, but we were there sitting in the very beginning so people can interact with something and start thinking and existing in this space.
I like the term you use, though. You're really priming their minds.
Yes.
To take in the rest of the mm-hmm. simulation.
Yes. People are very good with rules. I mean, that's why we have play. That's why we have games. That's why we have sports. We are very good at taking a view of the world. So if I tell you, or you tell me, now we're in an interview, and the rules of the interview are you ask questions and I answer them, now I know. Now I know how I'm supposed to be behaving. And so that can really, you can apply that to any experience, really. You can start people out and say, this is what the experience is going to be, and here's what you're going to do, and here's what you're going to learn. And then, you know, a lot of times it's like, did you learn that? You know, you're trying to figure out afterwards. But so that's actually, we have a tendency to think of games as something that it's not something we do. Are you a gamer? Well, no, I don't play games all the time. Well, the answer is you probably play a lot more than you think you do. We just don't use the definition of play the way Studio Cipher uses the definition, or some of these game researchers. I shouldn't just put it on us. And so we have to realize that we're very good at entering spaces and saying, well, what do I do here?
Very interesting. Another idea that's interesting to me is that maybe 30 years ago, if I was going to go into a simulation area of a Kenyan slum, maybe they would have handed me a piece of paper, or maybe somebody would have explained it to me, or there would have been another means of conveying the primer information to me. But now a young person going into this kind of situation is going to see one of your computers, and mm-hmm. they're going to have interactive quizzes, and it's a whole different idea of, or a whole different conduit of conveying this information. And so how does this different conduit, this computer that has an interactive possibility, affect the concept of fun or games or play?
Well, the interesting thing is that not as much as you think. So one of the things we definitely learned here at IU, and I'm going to name drop Julia Fox, her class on media equivalency has helped us a lot in how we view a lot of things. So the funny thing about our human brains, we think about the brain a lot, is the brain cannot distinguish what is real from what isn't. So if you're watching a movie, for instance, and something comes towards you, you're going to lean back. You're going to, oh, something just came towards me, because your brain interprets the signals as coming towards. So as we move more towards bringing in more audio visual stuff, it's much easier to kind of fool the brain into saying, oh, this is a normal space. This is something that I'm used to, because I'm used to sound and I'm used to moving things. And so I just hand you a piece of paper and say, this is what the rules are, you can do that. I mean, people are very, very good at that. That's how we learn a lot of the time. But if I can do that in a manner that my brain kind of interprets as safe or not that unusual, then it'll do it more readily.
You know, I think of an aunt of mine who is 91 years old, and she watches her great-great-grandchildren and her great-great-nieces, and with all their computers and their cell phones and all the things that they're doing for entertainment. And she will say, very convincingly, when I was a girl in the 1920s, we didn't have all of that, and I think we had more fun. And so we'd say, well, Auntie, what do you mean? She said, well, we had to use our imagination. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the picture of Mickey Mouse or of a forest or of an alligator. We had to create the alligator. We had to create the mouse. We had to create. We didn't have things that were given to us. We weren't being entertained. We had to create our own entertainment. Any thoughts about that?
I would say that in a certain sense, she is very correct, because we get fed a lot of media to us. There isn't a lot expected of us to be producers of media. We are generally consumers of media. That's how, especially if I talk to you in the 80s and 90s, that's what especially a radio or TV person would say. Oh yeah, well, we give them the entertainment and they consume it. But the thing about interactive media now, especially with Facebook, is that we are starting to turn people back into producers. Because there are four kind of main goals that people have when they play games. We call these the Bartle types. Richard Bartle, who is a researcher in the UK, came up with, he studied the people who played his games. And he kind of figured out that, well, there's really four things that people want. They want achievement. They want a higher score. They want to feel good because they did better than somebody else. They want to explore the environment. So when I'm talking about fun and learning the rules, I'm talking about the explorers. There's also socializers, the people who actually don't care about the game, but they like the people who live in the magic circle. So they want to interact with those people. They don't necessarily care about the rules or the playing per se. They just want to interact with the other people. And then we have the influencers, who are kind of a more forceful version of the socializers, who want to cause other people to act in a certain way. And sometimes that's in a negative way. They want to ruin their day because they get a charge out of that. Or sometimes it's a more positive, I want to get this group of people to do this because we'll donate a bunch of money somewhere. So socializing, the urge to socialize, is actually coming out a lot in games these days, because games are adding ways that people can create their own things, whether it's drawings or game levels that other people can play in, or anything like that. That's really become, in these structures we built, people start to become creative, and even artists. If you, the song Farmville, I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to this have heard of Farmville, and they probably hate it. They either love it or they hate it, because you either are in the magic circle and you think this is the greatest thing and you want to get money and grow your farm and whatever, or you're outside the magic circle and you're like, why are you bugging me with this stuff?
I think I'm like that.
Well, what's interesting is actually a lot of people are playing Farmville not for points or to grow their crops, but they're actually using it as a painting canvas.
In what way?
Well, they're using
it as a socializer.
As a socializer, okay. So they are using it literally as a canvas. You can get. I've seen a lot of people. You can get these like bales of hay, and they're different colors. So you buy tons of bales of hay, and then you place them around your farm, and it creates a picture. And then they can show their friends, look at this thing I did. And so it has nothing to do with really any of that other stuff. It has nothing to do with learning, but it's socializing. It's being creative inside of a context, which actually then is learning, because I am applying the rules in ways that they weren't necessarily intended to be implied, and I'm changing the context of the magic circle. Now, instead of a game where I grow crops, we are now in an art gallery. But that's all player controlled. That the game designers had no intention of that, and they're not stopping it, because the more people want to do that stuff, the more they'll play their game and get them income. But it's the creators of the magic circle often don't have a clue what's going to be done with the magic circle once it's out there in the world.
Back in the 50s or the 60s, I think there was a, in the management, in the area of management, there was a model that was created called transactional analysis, TA. And in TA, there's a, every adult has a child in them, an adult, a parent. They have these different aspects of their personality and how they use them. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's other personality tests that sort of grew out of those. But it's interesting. So it sounds like Richard Bartle has created a sort of a personality test within.
Yes, actually, if
this,
you
interactive game community.
Yes, if you search on Google for like your Bartle type, you'll get a quiz. And it, that quiz was very much specific to the game he was researching, but you can do it. You can find your Bartle type and find out, well, this is why I play games, because I probably like these things.
Fascinating. Let's move on. We looked at what you do and how you do it in create a game, create an interactive scenario in Oklahoma for Feed the Children in the simulated Kenyan slum. Let's bring it closer to home, and let's go to the museum in Chicago, a little bit closer to home.
Yes.
You guys have something going on there that also is an interactive scene.
Yes.
What is that?
So the Field Museum, which is the Natural History Museum in Chicago, this is about 5 years ago, launched a new, practically a new wing of their downstairs area, which is the Ancient Americas exhibit. And this exhibit is actually a series of exhibits that leads up to their traditional Native American wing. And what this is it's talking about Native Americans, and not necessarily, so this is North and Central and South America, the Native peoples who are from the prehistory up to about the Columbian times. That's about when the exhibit starts. We have a series of six games that are very short. Their play times are anywhere between 60 and 90 seconds, and they're in the very first room. Because the first thing that they want their visitors to know is what it was like to be an innovator in ancient times. So we have a tendency to think of innovation as a highly technical process with new internet stuff or new phones. Like, I've innovated and I've created a new phone. Well, for them, the Native peoples, it was actually fairly similar. It was just much simpler. So an innovation might be I have learned how to domesticate llamas so I can stay in the higher climes much longer. Or I'm living on the beach and I want to fish because there's lots of fish in the sea. Well, what's the best way to do that? And the first thing I learned is, oh, I make a hook. Wow, I can catch fish that way. I don't just have to grab them with my hands. Or they learn that they can use a net, and suddenly I can pull in several fish at once. And that dramatically increased the life expectancy and how many people you can feed. And we're talking, I mean, this is stuff that we see now, and we think, oh, that's so simple.
That's right. How many people pick up a fish hook and say, whoa, what an innovation.
Yeah. But for them, it was life-changing, culture-changing. And so they wanted to allow the people who visit this exhibit to experience a little bit of that rush. And so they tasked us with creating 6 games, so 2 for each region, so 2 for the forest region, 2 for the mountain region, and 2 for the coastal region, that allows people very, very quickly to see, if not the act of innovation itself, but what the different innovations were used for.
How much research did you have to do for this to prepare a game, you know, and be accurate and true to the period of time?
Well, we actually, the art style, talk about art first, the artifacts, as we call them, of the game, it's very stylized because we didn't want to pin it to any one specific group of people. And the thing about a game that's that short is you actually can't pull in and remember many of the details. So we wanted to keep things kind of as simple and clean as possible. So the art actually kind of evokes old cave paintings. So kind of the way the people then would depict themselves. And so the research there actually was fairly simple because the Field Museum has lots of researchers and they know exactly what they want. So we say, what should we show them? And they said, well, we really want them to know the process for how humans eat acorns, because there's a very specific process you have to go through to make acorns edible and turn them into bread. Or we want people to know, and we're talking about the learning objectives here are very short. We want people to know that the best way to fish is to use a net.
Mm-hmm. 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 Oh, this is fascinating. And how long has that display been there? How long has your interactive situation been in Chicago?
That display has been there for about 5 years.
Okay.
And I believe the target was to have it exist for at least 10. So it'll probably be there for 5 more years. Although, unless they really want to go through and redesign the exhibit, it might be there indefinitely. So we're very proud of that.
Now let's bring us even closer to home. Okay. And I know you all have done some work that I think is very interesting in the Indianapolis Zoo.
Yes.
So tell us about that and how the idea, if you can, and I know we've gotten away from it, but take us again through maybe how play, games, fun, and education are integrated into the Indianapolis Zoo.
Okay. Well, the first thing I should say is that I lost my train of thought. So
before you go on, though, let me just say this. We actually had a telephone call from a listener who would like for you to reiterate once again, what is the difference between, well, actually, let me restate the question. Can you talk about what is the difference between work and play?
Ah. Well, there's actually a lot of people who are trying to marry the two.
Okay.
So the interesting, let's hear, work. So work and play actually have very similar aspects to them. You go to a place, which you could call the magic circle. I'm going to my job. I'm giving a context. I have rules there for here's what I'm doing at my job. Here's how I interact with my coworkers. Probably, well, the reason that work stops being fun is because you do it for a very long time. That's one of the main reasons. So if we define fun as being something that's novel, we have novel rules, we have novel ways of applying these rules and novel ways of interacting with people. If our job is in any way repetitive, we might even get that fun the very beginning. I'm going to work, I'm entering Magic Circle, I'm in a new context, I'm doing these sort of things. But after a while you learn everything. And then your brain goes, well, I know what's happening next. And then goes, now we're done.
And at the outset, or at the beginning of our time together here, at the beginning of our interview, you had said that what happens is that when you don't have that thrill of doing it again, you find another game.
Yes.
But in your work...
In your work, you can't.
Yeah.
So if you want to keep your
unless
work,
you have a job like yours.
Unless you have a job like mine, or a job where you have
like mine,
different clients and things like that. So the way to... A way to make work more game-like is to find ways to change it, change the rules a little bit. And what that might entail, if the caller is looking to make their work more play-like, is to start creating their own rules, even if they don't tell anybody. If you create your own rules and you change the context just a little bit, you know, we talk about having an imagination. I'm not necessarily suggesting that everybody runs around and start acting like lunatics, because that could be what that sounds like I just said. But what I really mean is if you change the context in your own brain, this is what I'm doing now. This is the way I'm interacting. Today I'm going to never use the word money. Now I have created a play in my own head. I've created that sort of thing in my own context. And this might be a play of one. I might be doing that just by myself.
You know what's very interesting? That this reminds me of when Albert Einstein was just what they might have called a simple clerk at his job at the patents office, wherever he was working in Germany. The idea when they talked to people about really what he was doing that while he was at the job. He's recreating the rules every day because he's doing... that's what he was doing, almost what you described. That's what I perceived it. He would change a rule for himself, but it was a creative process. It wasn't something just droning on and on and on and on.
Because the other thing, and I haven't really mentioned it, but one of the implications of all of this is basically that our brains are amazing pattern-matching machines. We love patterns. Once we find a pattern, our brain goes, ooh, that's a pattern. Can I apply it somewhere else? Can I use it? And the other thing is that once a pattern stops being new, then the fun drains away because we're not using something new anymore. We're using an old thing. And so it likes new patterns, not necessarily old patterns. Shall I talk about the zoo now?
Yes, please. Let's go to the zoo.
Okay. So a little bit of background about the zoo.
And before you go on, let me just say to our listeners, my name is William Morse. You're listening to Interchange, and I'm talking with Nathan Mishler, really about play, games, fun, all of these different ideas, and how these ideas are integrated into interactive computer games that Nathan designs. Go ahead, Nathan, into Indianapolis Zoo.
Okay, the Indianapolis Zoo, and we've been talking to them for several years because they realize, and actually the Field Museum has realized this too, museums in general are realizing that really what they have is a conversation with their viewers. And so you squander the conversation if you just plop people in front of animals and go, look, there's an animal, or look, there's a thing under glass. And the zoo, and this is something we love about the zoo, is they really describe themselves as a conservation group with a zoo attached. So their main goal is conservation. And they're starting to realize that they can use games to encourage people to not only teach them about conservation, but to raise money for that conservation. So last May, they got a new exhibit for cheetahs. And they actually have a physical running track that you can run against a virtual cheetah. So the cheetah is represented by a line of LEDs that run down the track. And they say, go, and you run as fast as you can. And about five steps later, the cheetah catches up with you and you lose. So that's a game with a losing state, not really a winning state. And so, so they brought us in to make a game about tigers because they have a new tiger exhibit. And so we have a game. It's called Tiger Trackers. It's on Facebook right now. You can play it. It's open. It's free to play for everybody, anywhere. And it teaches people not just about tigers, but about the conservation and how people do it. And so people can come and play that game. And any money that we bring with this game, it not only teaches them about tigers and science, but also any money that we bring in, we're going to share with the zoo and conservation, as well as keeping ourselves fed.
this time has wound down too fast.
Yes, it has.
Before we go, though, can you please tell our guests, how could they play this game on, tell our listeners, how can they play this game on Facebook?
You can find a link to it at my website. Go to studiocypher.com. That's studiocypher.com. And there should be a link to the game on the front page of the website.
Very good. You're listening to Interchange. My name is William Morris, and we have had a fascinating interview. Nathan, I hope you'll come back and talk about this some more.
Oh,
this
I'd love
is
to.
Fascinating. We've been with Nathan Mishler, a Bloomingtonian here who's with a company called Studio Cypher. And thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
In the last minute, William Moore shares an article about ominous signs for unions.
Last month, Target fired Tashauna Green, but not for being bad at her job. They fired her, she says, for trying to make her job better. Green, a 21-year-old single mom, was the most public supporter of a campaign to unionize the workers at her Long Island, New York store. Before an unsuccessful union vote there, she told the New York Times and other media outlets about the challenge of supporting her daughter on $8 an hour and insufficient hours. Her photo appeared in several newspapers. Target, which has more than 1,760 American stores, earned $704 million in profits in the second quarter. Like its big box competitor Walmart, Target has zero union employees in the United States. That means that none of Target's workers may bargain collectively over wages or the company's refusal to schedule more workers for full-time hours. More than 50 of Costco's nearly 600 stores, in contrast, are unionized. Target isn't claiming Green didn't show up for work or that she couldn't do the job. Instead, the company put out a statement saying she was fired for acting, quote unquote, in an overly hostile, disruptive manner. Green and representatives of the United Food and Commercial Workers, the UFCW union, say that's just a hokey, tricky way of saying she wanted to join a union. And Target doesn't want its employees to have that option. The UFCW is filing charges with the National Labor Relations Board, saying Target illegally punished her for engaging in activism. It would be nice to say that what happened to Green is unusual, or that going to the government means she'll get justice. But the truth is that companies fire workers for union activity all the time, and they often get away with it. Research from the Economic Policy Institute shows that more than a third of companies respond to union elections by firing union activists. Other tactics that make union workers fear losing their jobs are even more common, according to the Institute. Under the current law, companies dead set on keeping out unions have a lot to gain by firing workers like Tashauna Green. Firing union supporters removes them from the workplace, and it sends a chilling message to their co-workers. Since none of us is perfect, it can be hard to prove to the government that union activism was the reason someone was fired. With appeals, the process can take years. Even if a worker wins a case, usually the stiffest punishment a company faces is bringing the worker back to work, paying the wages she or he missed, and posting a notice saying that it won't fire workers for union organizing in the future. Unfortunately, that's a small price to pay for refusing to negotiate with your employees over their wages and benefits. Workers who step up to organize their workplaces are really whistleblowers. They break a silence that can otherwise leave people thinking that the problems they're experiencing are theirs alone. They create an avenue for addressing workplace issues that can otherwise hurt not only workers, but also all of us as consumers and communities. These workplace whistleblowers deserve the respect of our culture and the protections of our legal system.
Got an idea, a thought, a comment? Contact us at interchange@wfhb.org. That's interchange@wfhb.org. Thanks for listening to Interchange. Our engineer is Shane Young. Interchange is produced by William Morris. The executive producer is January Jones. Theme music is by Jamil Effiam and Jackie Matu. Now, stay tuned for the best in jazz on Stardust with Tillman, right here on your community radio station, WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.